Live from Burbank, California, where it's okay to cut and run. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he's leaving CBS after four decades. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, folks. Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, need machines, pain sponges, conspiracy theorists, or as I like to call them, independent speculative investigators. I got some mail, Jim, from people who have a contention, have a bone to pick with me about my approach towards 9/11 truth. Look,
you weren't tough enough, they're saying?
Well, it's not a matter of tough enough, and it still doesn't deter from my original argument. I was accused by, let's go ahead, we'll read an email then.
Okay. Oh,
let me set up the show first, okay, and then we'll do this. There's a lot of stuff that happened that, on the periphery here and in the news that I find interesting that I wouldn't mind talking about if we get to it, as usual. But on the show today, John Strasbaugh, the author of Black Like You, will tell us about the history of minstrelsy and the evolution of our discomfort around ever making a joke that might ever refer to black people as white people and some of the vice versa. Not so much there, though, but mostly on our part. I mean, literally, yeah. As a comic, you know, you can't even say I was talking to a black guy without wondering whether or not, without a certain amount of self-censorship, and whether that goes both ways and what the history of that is and how the blacks have appropriated or absorbed some of that legacy. And it's interesting. I'm looking forward to talking to him. Rod Nordland from Newsweek is the foreign, their chief foreign correspondent to talk about things foreign, specifically Iraq. Robert Greenwald, the documentary filmmaker, will be here to talk a bit about the film he's produced, which is the Tom DeLay film, The Big Buy. Tom DeLay's corrupt Congress. I can't remember. Is that the subheading? It's close. Svetlana, our prostitute/movie reviewer, will be here. We're also going to be talking to Professor William Chandler from Harper's Magazine on the 10 greatest America's 10 greatest mistakes. That should be interesting. Now, the conspiracy thing is, the reason I'm making, there's a point to be had about this, about the schism between the Democrats. You have moderate Democrats who think that there are people that are liberal fundamentalists and that there's a break in the party about expectations. This is primarily around the Iraq war and where to stand on that war, where they should stand conclusively. All of them, all the Democrats should say, pull the guys out now. Let's get out of there. We got to stop even using this cut and run thing. As a joke, we can't even make reference to that frame. The cutting and running frame is being so plastered into the media by the Republicans right now. This is what they're going to run on. The immigration thing is stalled in the House. That's not going to happen in terms of legislating. What they're going to run on is this. This is it, that the Democrats cannot make up their mind about what to do about the war in Iraq. The war in Iraq is a failure, and there's no way to deny that. And you get people like Ken Mellman going on Wolf Blitzer's show yesterday, or maybe this was today, this is on June 20th, and you just listen to how many times they're repeating this. He repeated it three different ways, three different times, and then Blitzer appropriated the frame. We can't even, it's not cutting and running. It's regrouping. It's making a different decision. It's going a different direction. There's something incredibly, not just hypocritical, but wrong about beating the hell out of a country, occupying the country, killing thousands of their civilians, and then saying like, hey, can we get you a Band-Aid? Here, we're going to help you out. We're going to just stay here forever to facilitate what? It's like Representative Murtha said, that it's not going to, it's just going to go on like this. It's never going to stop until we pull out. And then you get this report today about this stuff that was found out about these two California National Guardsmen from 2004. Barbara Boxer, let me tell you something. What an amazing thing she did here. She actually did what a congressperson is supposed to do. Senator Barbara Boxer, the Democrat from California out here, was approached by the mother of a California National Guardsman, a woman named, by the name of Nadia McCaffrey, who was not satisfied with how the military explained the death of her son. Her son was supposedly killed in an ambush, and she was not satisfied. So Barbara Boxer pushed the Pentagon to investigate, and they find out that these two guys, her son and this other guy, these two National Guardsmen, were not killed in an ambush. They were murdered by the Iraqi National Guard members that they were working with. They were on patrol with some Iraqi National Forces guys, and they were killed by them. Now, this is 2004. Perhaps things have gotten better. But see, this is a great example of it's almost a metaphor for what this conflict looks like. Now, where am I going with this? How am I bringing this all around? Again, another schism in the Democratic Party. Rahm Emanuel, the guy from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, is stepping down. Now, this is a controversial guy who's had some fights with Howard Dean over the DNC about how to run the campaign, where to put the money, how to do it, who's going to run. That's another schism within the Democratic Party. But despite everything else, we're outraising money. We've got more money than the GOP for these midterms, which is impressive. But getting back to the cut-and-run thing, we can't even say this is a joke. I'm not even sure we should call the Iraq War a war anymore. I think we might start having to call it an occupation. But here's what it says. Ken Melman on Wolf Blitzer says three times, he says, quote, this is Ken Melman, and there's a debate going on within the Democratic Party. Some are saying we need to cut and run. Others are saying we need to cut and jog. And still others are saying we need to cut and walk. Do you see what he's doing? He's just pounding that frame into the heads of people that might know in their hearts that this war is wrong. They might know it instinctively that this war is wrong, but the way they keep, the way they keep repeating this cut and run thing, that it makes those people go, "Yeah, man, we're Americans. We're gonna be loyal here. We're gonna stick with this thing." I mean, maybe there's a different way to do it. The Democrats have got to make a decision. They've got to say what they want. All of them say, get them out now, get them out in 6 months, commit to it, and let's get on with this thing. But I just can't. How does this relate to the conspiracy theorists? Not that I'm not even going to use that. Look, if you believe what you want to believe, you can believe your science. There's two. The problem with the 9/11 conspiracy idea, the 9/11 truth thing, is that look, there are explanations for everything. And I may talk about this ad hominem, as some guy accused me of. He said, I think it's rather ironic in this email that you used a completely ad hominem approach to support your dismissal of the arguments put forth by persons who choose to believe that the attacks on September 11th were conducted in a manner inconsistent with the official story. Fine. Inconsistent with the official story. But still, there is scientific explanations for almost everything that has happened. And you have your scientific explanations or conflicting scientific explanations. Bottom line is, no one has ever seen towers that size fall for any reason. So any engineering explanation is going to be what it is. But still, there is a moment that we can't explain necessarily. And you can pick sides, whatever you want. Look, if it's true, I hope you can prove it's true. I'm not even going to disregard the whole thing. All I'm saying is that there is so much to indict this administration on what they did, what they did. I mean, you've got the CIA secret prisons, you've got torture at Guantanamo Bay, you've got torture at Abu Ghraib, you've got an illegal war, you've got an illegal election, there's a million things that you can assault these guys. You've got corruption in the House that is just starting to unfold. Duke Cunningham, Jerry Lewis, the Safavian, you've got Tom DeLay going down. There's a million things that we can actually start to facilitate, even impeachment proceedings, if we get this House back, if we stay to the goal, which is if we want to prosecute this administration, it'll be possible if we get the House back. If you want to walk into the House of Representatives and say, finally, it's time to prove what happened on 9/11, I don't think you can get much traction there. That's why I say keep it as a hobby. I'm not saying give it up. I'm not even saying that you're wrong. If you want to choose to believe what you're going to believe against this science for your science, do what you want. But I'm just saying that keep it as a hobby and let's get the House reorganized so we can actually maybe impeach the president. How would that be? Is that all right? We'll be back with John Strasbaugh in just a second.
Now, militants keep launching rockets at his trousers. Mark Maron.
I know, it's bothersome. Hey, folks, look, as a comic, as a white comic, I know there are certain things that are always taboo. Doesn't necessarily stop me. But one of them is certainly making jokes about black people. Really, no matter what the tone, if there are black people involved in the joke, there's going to be an issue. I mean, I've done racially charged jokes, but audiences don't even know how to receive them, even if they're not inappropriate. Even if you just mention race or the idea of race, as a white comic, there will be enough people in the audience who will be like, oh, I don't know if that... Just by virtue of me being a white guy, approaching the topic of race makes people unsure and judgmental. There is a history of what some would call racist comedy in this country, founded in minstrelsy. But our guest makes some arguments that mocking the other race is not always racist, but it is always provocative and confusing, for sure. The book is Black Like You. The author is John Strasbaugh. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks, Mark.
Look, now, let's talk. This book is very interesting. There's a lot of great historical elements about the history of minstrelsy and all the way up through blaxploitation, up through Dave Chappelle's show. But when you were embarked on this project, what was the overall point you were trying to make?
That pop culture is an arena that operates somewhat outside of polite and civil discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, pop culture is impolite. Sometimes it's incorrect. Sometimes it's rude, crude, lewd. And that's because it comes from us. We all make it. It gets taken over by business at some point, but we're all making it originally, or at least a lot of it. And maybe in our, since we went so politically correct over the last 20 years, I think there's an element, a certain element of repression there. You know, it's hard to be polite all the time.
Well, look, I'll be the first to admit, like, I had to learn this lesson that, you know, just the power and the censorship, self-censorship and a sort of group censorship that occurred because of political correctness, it's completely stifling and it works against creating a cultural dialogue.
Don't you think? I mean,
yes.
You know, look, I'm a big fan of polite conversation and civil discourse, but you need to have some outlet besides that because it doesn't always reflect private thought, private conversations, private attitudes, and if we can't air those, then we can't talk about them, then we're never going to fix them.
Or at the very least, if some entertainer or some writer or somebody who has the guts and the courage and the confidence to step out on the ice and put it out there to relieve some of that pressure, then nothing gets done. And I think it's completely repressive and malignant towards the culture at large. But let's get into the book. You know, now, a lot of people don't realize, but both black and white performers did minstrelsy well into the 20th century. When did it start? Where did it come from? And when did it become socially wrong?
Well, you could argue it was wrong all along. It starts in America. Minstrelsy starts at the end of the 1820s into the 1830s. It starts, interestingly enough, not down south where you might look for white racist mocking blacks, but in big cities up north, in the slums of New York and Boston and Buffalo and Philadelphia. And it starts with young white guys, mostly Irish, because the Irish at that point were considered as low as or lower than blacks on the social ladder, performing in these low-class, what were called variety theaters, blacking up their faces, singing these songs that they thought were, in many cases, authentic Southern black songs. And you can see how confused they are if you read the lyrics and listen to the songs themselves. They obviously, it's a little like early rock and roll in some ways, because they like the music, they're attracted to the music, they're even attracted to some things about black culture, but at the same time they're expressing all this hatred and racism. So they're both embracing it and setting themselves apart from it.
The hatred and racism by virtue of how they are characterizing these people?
Yeah, they're using the most loathsome stereotypes, and it's just, it's incredibly insulting.
Because it's interesting, you make sort of an interesting case in the first chapter of your book around that drag queen who is a current drag queen who is utilizing blackface in a way that is confounding to in terms of how to describe it, whether it is socially inappropriate or not.
And you can see that with the, in fact, through the whole history of blackface and whiteface and other kinds of ethnic drag, you can see the confusion there. It's always love and hate, attraction and repulsion. There's insult and sincere imitation. This person, Shirley Q. Licker, who the drag artist who's doing blackface now, his performances are a confusion of some of it's just you just want to smack him because it's bad old stereotypes. But then other times he's speaking through this character the same way that, you know, a lot of other comics speak through characters to make some social commentary. And then you're laughing, but you're feeling guilty because the guy's in blackface. It's very confusing.
Well, and then it becomes more confusing because it seems that the black community has absorbed, you know, the legacy of minstrelsy in the sense that, you know, first of all, you know, I am out of the dialogue. I can't make any jokes that would even be considered inappropriate. I mean, I used to do Tough Crowd a lot with Colin Quinn.
Mm-hmm. And
there are certain cats that come at it, you know, I have a built-in liberal guilt, but it's it seems that the cats who didn't and just would go at the black dudes and they'd go at each other, there was a certain respect there. But if I come at it sort of, you know, pussyfooting around, then it's, you know, my guilt indicts me.
Well, I got to tell you, I do think we've become sissies about all this in a lot of ways. And it's I'm not sure it's a good thing, because then the dialogue never happens. If you're afraid to say anything and you're afraid to crack a joke once in a while, we'll never talk about these things.
Well, I think the most important thing that you made note of, it, certainly at the beginning of the book, in terms of how to approach this today, is that by being part of this sort of alternative comedy hipster scene, is that what's happened in entertainment, certainly in comedy, is that there are distinctly different audiences for black and white comedy. Even socially liberal comedy is not attended by the black community really at all. And I think a lot of that separation has come from a lack of this dialogue.
I agree. There was a time when audiences, you would, like in the vaudeville years and even in the minstrel show days, the performers on stage would be black and white, audiences would be separated by an aisle or something, but there'd still be black and white people in there, and Irish immigrants and Italian immigrants and everybody else, and watching all this stuff go on. And in some strange, perverse ways, the message that I think was being transmitted is that here we all are, and we got to get used to all being here. In the last 20, 30 years, the message has been very different. It's been, no, we're all separate, we're all our own little hyphenate communities, and we're going to stay very separate.
And that is a byproduct of political correctness.
Absolutely.
That differentiation, that's interesting. Now, in terms of, like, what about well, maybe we'll hold off on that for a second. We'll do another segment. What about how there's a history of white people stealing just about everything from black people? I mean, even Jerry Lewis apparently stole, you know, a lot of his act from somebody up in Harlem. That I can understand that type of resentment on behalf of the black community, more than I... I don't know what I'm trying to say, but it seems to me that's the real issue.
It's called, who was it? John Leland, who wrote the book called Hip, called it The Myth of the White Boy Who Stole the Blues. See, I don't quite buy this. I don't buy that any cultural product can be stolen from anyone else. Once you put it out there, it's out there for everybody to use. You as a comic know that. In the old days, comics used to steal each other's best lines all the time. People are a little more careful about that now, but it used to happen all the time.
Stay with us a minute, John. Hang out. We're gonna keep talking. We're going to take a break. We're with John Strassbaugh. The book is Black Like You.
Can't have a baby because of stress. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Our guest is John Strassbaugh. The book is Black Like You. We're in the middle of a conversation about, it's about a lot of things, but what you just said to me, John, is that there is no stealing. There is no white people stealing black people's music.
It's not just that. It's if you think of them as separate cultures, then yes, of course, white performers have watched black performers and enjoyed what they were doing and stolen it. Black performers have done that to white performers. Jewish performers have imitated Italian performers. If you look at one of the reasons to look at minstrelsy, which nobody listens to anymore, is that it's one of the first American pop musics, and it's such an obvious blend of African, the banjo is an African instrument, and they were all banging on their banjos, and Celtic, and Anglo, and it came together and became American pop music. And
what?
I think ever since then, you know, it's showbiz, and show business people rip one another off all the time.
Yeah, haven't white people kind of made more money with black music than black the other way around, though?
You can make that argument, I guess. I'm not saying it's not a legitimate argument, but I wonder if we looked at it in a larger context, what do you want to say about hip-hop? Hip-hop wouldn't exist without, you know, it wouldn't have been invented in a purely black culture.
Well,
it was invented in America, and America's not black or white. It's a mongrel Creole mutt culture.
Yeah, I agree, and it's just interesting because I'm just trying to take this from my own personal point of view, because I'm a blues head. I play guitar. I've always had tremendous respect for blues musicians. Even my favorite comic is Richard Pryor, and I can only trace that to the virtue of his honesty on stage. It really is not a black or white thing. It's just I've never seen anybody be more emotionally available and candid.
There you go.
And I think that there is something to be said about people who have a strong community identification, whereas a lot of us white mutts, really don't. We feel a little disconnected from ourselves and from our emotions. I don't know if that has something to do with it. Maybe that's just my personal experience.
Well, I do think that American culture would be a far less rich and fun and interesting and certainly less cool culture without the enormous impact and contribution of Black Americans. That's so obvious to me, I don't understand. Sometimes you hear conservatives, trying to make believe that American culture is Western European white culture, but you also hear liberals saying it sometimes. And that's, you don't have to look around this culture for more than about 5 seconds to realize that that's, you don't know beans about American culture if you think that.
Well, I think that also now with the way music is functioning, and certainly younger people, that what you're talking about, the fusion continues to occur, continues to evolve,
yeah.
And it continues certainly to happen more so in music than I think any other field, because you don't see it in movies, you don't really see it on television, you're still talking about old roles, stereotypes, but in music and in youth culture, there does seem to be some communication happening. I'm just sorry it doesn't happen more across the board.
Absolutely, I completely agree.
And what was very interesting to me, even in watching Spike Lee's Bamboozled, mm-hmm. which, his movies are inconsistent in general, but to see a minstrel show, done in the honored in terms of its authenticity and how it was presented with full television technology was really off-putting, awesome, and stunning in a way that it has never left me. The part of that movie where they do actually put a minstrel show on television, which is obviously a metaphor, but what if you saw the film, right?
Yeah.
What is profound about it is that you see that this was Black minstrelsy. This was not white minstrelsy. This was not Irish kids putting on blackface.
Right.
It was Black people putting on blackface, which happened a lot as well, yes?
Toward the end of minstrelsy's days, end of the 19th century, into the 20th century, most minstrel performers were Black performers in blackface.
And he was able to capture the sort of identity issues around that, but also able to see how the talent of the performers, transcended even the context of minstrelsy.
In that weird American way, minstrelsy was a platform and an entree to show business for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Black performers, composers, dancers, writers, singers, who might not have had that entree otherwise. It's a goofy American version of doing things, but they go on to be jazz performers, vaudeville, Broadway, the blues, and it was a paycheck. And showbiz people, as you well know, are often asked to do things that the rest of us think are demeaning, and the rest of us are asked to do things that show business people wouldn't do.
But it's unfortunate that the institutional racism that exists in most businesses and in mm-hmm. this culture in general, it still causes that to happen.
Well, I think to me that's an example of how, like, culture is often... Culture operates on a different plane than politics and society in general, and sometimes it's kind of out ahead. And certainly in the music industry, you can see it being out ahead of politics and society in general.
But it's
so
still,
maybe it's a bit of a ideal that we can look to.
Yeah, I still think it is incredibly difficult for ethnic groups, Blacks, Latinos, all ethnic groups, and women as well, to have a fair shake in the big game of pop culture. You may disagree with me, but I still think there are obstacles.
Oh, of course there are, but I think it's getting better all the time,
uh-huh.
and it's certainly better now than it was 50 years ago, and it's not improving quickly enough. But once again, I think if we're not allowed to talk about this stuff, if we're just going to hide from it and ignore it all, then it's never going to change.
Yeah, and also it doesn't help when you have a government in this country and a split in the country, almost on a 50-50 line around issues about immigration and also around issues of class, which aren't addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the limitations and the inability of this country to have a dialogue around class really kind of nourishes and maintains these stereotypes and these obstacles.
Class class has always been the elephant in the room that we have never dealt with in America.
Now let's talk about the black community in terms of you know, why. Let's take Chappelle for an example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Chappelle said that he quit his show because he was basically becoming what he saw as a contemporary Stephen Fetchit, that he was being misinterpreted by white audiences, and he felt that he was becoming a caricature and misrepresenting the black community. Now there is a schism within the black community around the older generation, the newer generation, around a slang like, you know, Bill Cosby speaking out against the kids. What do you see there?
Well, you know, I'm so sorry that he stopped doing the show because it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And he was doing blackface and whiteface and all those other things and challenging people to think about stuff. And I really wish he was continuing to do it. I also don't know, you know, John Leguizamo talks about this a lot, about like how much is especially a comic performer supposed to be a representative of his culture. John Leguizamo says, I don't want to be a poster boy for Latinos at all. I'd make a terrible poster boy. Look at me. So, you know, and then...
Right, so you're saying it comes loaded, that there's an expectation, even as a liberal talk show host, there's an expectation that is on you whether you like it or not. Whether you want to honor it or not, it's a pressure.
I'm sure of that.
But I'm talking about that ethnically as well.
I think comics are the ones who maybe are best able to work around that. Look at Sarah Silverman, for God's sake. Look at the stuff that she throws into her routine now. It's extraordinary. And 10 years ago, she never would have gotten away with it. 10 years ago, Andrew Dice Clay just couldn't say bad things about women. They hounded him off the stage.
Mm-hmm.
She talks about rape and 9/11 and race and all that stuff. Whether or not you think it's funny, whether or not you think it's appropriate, that's a personal judgment, but it's interesting that she's getting away with it.
That's
now.
Right, and she does it all in a very cute, charming
that,
way.
That it doesn't hurt that she's easy on the eyes and cute and sweet.
Well, John Strassbaugh, we got to go. I appreciate it. It was great talking to you. The book is Black Like You. Pick it up. I hope to talk to you again, man.
I'd love to do it. Thanks, Mark.
All right, take it easy.
Okay.
We will be back with Svetlana in just a second. Hang out.
And now he's top of the list for the first face transplant, Mark Maron.
Well, as long as it's not blackface, I think I'll be okay and not be judged wrong. Unless it's real.
Vaudeville's coming back, so.
Well, according to our last guest, it's going to be controversial from here on out, forever. I'm hoping, you know, because that makes it interesting. People, there's a lot of stuff going on in the news that's disturbing. We almost went to nuclear... a Mach 7 or level 10 or whatever it is with North Korea yesterday. Now Bolton's telling them that, you know, they can't, they don't want to, we're not going to talk to you because we don't like the pretenses of the talk. And things are rough. So we're going to lighten it up a little. Here with us tonight is our entertainment correspondent. She's new to Hollywood, but getting older to it. But she is an old hand at entertaining. She works as a prostitute here in town. Welcome, Svetlana
Mark, you're illiterate. Maybe one day.
I can't even read it, and I have it written down. How sad is that?
17 consonants will do it to you.
How are you?
I'm a little pissy.
Oh.
I've not been that festive
good,
lately.
Good, always good for radio.
Apparently. But it's been a very quiet week for me, Mark.
Uh-huh.
You know, apparently the stress of what's going on in North Korea and Iraq, a lot of clients have been calling with outbreaks of herpes.
What? Oh, really?
Yes, I had 14 cancellations last week, and that was only on Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
And when Condi called to cancel, it put me over the edge.
Whoa, back up. Condi's a client?
She's not more a client. She's my tea partner.
A tea partner with herpes now?
No, she didn't have herpes.
Okay,
was just having issues. Pardon me. I'm getting too excited.
Okay.
I talk about Condi. She does something special in my heart.
Okay.
I go to her place once a month.
Uh-huh.
We drink chamomile, and she plays piano for me. It's like a little jam session. It's very fun.
Is there outfits involved or anything?
I have outfits, and she has devices and different, you know, fun stuff. But she is amazing. She plays piano from Rachmaninoff to Billie Holiday to Keith Urban.
Keith Urban?
She's fantastic with Keith Urban.
Did you ever... He's the guy who's going to marry Nicole
Kidman.
He's
homosexual. I don't know what Nicole is doing, but maybe this is a pattern. Or to look at him, he has highlights. Anybody with highlights is homosexual.
Really?
Well, maybe not in Venice Beach, but...
There's a lot of homosexuals around here that need to be told that they're homosexual.
Well, yeah, get a buzz cut, do something. Uh-huh. But the beautiful voice, Conde. If only she could talk the way she sings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when she makes these speeches, I tell her, you sound like a mouse on crack.
Mouse,
but you put her near a karaoke machine, she's an angel.
Really? You guys do
angel.
Karaoke?
We do everything. She likes the oriental spots.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's good. She's good. She, you know, she dresses up. She calls herself Shaniqua. She does like a little fun thing for herself.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
But, you know, I taught her to walk in heels.
You taught her that?
Yes, I did. I told her, Conde, you look like you have pulled up your rectum. She left so hard. We have such a good time.
Well, that's nice.
It's really nice.
So now you're from Russia, and I imagine like everywhere else other than America on this planet, soccer is very popular.
Yes.
Do you like soccer?
I love soccer.
Are you watching the World Cup?
I'm not. I'm a little. I'm boycott.
Yeah.
Boycotting because this is the first year. Usually, Mark, entire teams hire me. I give them group rate. You know, I am personally responsible for Brazil's victory in 2002.
That was you,
personally
huh?
responsible. Yes. Goal. You know what I'm saying?
Did they come up with that with you?
Well, you know, when you give pleasure, the things that come out of men's mouths, it's unbelievable. I was not invited this year. And you know why? The market is flooded because prostitution is legal in Germany. Did you know that?
Oh, I didn't know that.
The Germans, they are civilized people. Well, besides the little mishap of slaughtering 11 million Jews, gays, and gypsies.
Besides that,
they are very civilized people. And they have good pastries.
They do?
Light and flaky.
Really?
Really nice.
Mm,
yeah.
Have I had German pastries? Strudel. Right, they have the flavor.
Oh, you're
yeah.
Jewish. I forgot.
Easy.
Right. No, hey, I had Jews, good tippers. Good tippers. The point is, Mark, thousands of young girls from Ukraine, Poland, Hungary, they arrive en masse to supply services, and who is left high and dry?
You.
Me.
Oh,
me.
I'm sorry.
It's very sad, and I killed it. Here in America, my political clients, they appreciate smart, well-read, savvy, cosmopolitan women like myself.
Sure, sure.
Because they can have orgasm and discuss public policy in the same 10-minute cycle.
Oh, that's something.
Yeah, it's efficient. But these World Cup fans, you know, let's be honest, they're fat, drunk idiots, barely get an erection, let alone discuss the ramifications of the United States conquering the least untainted sport in the universe, not dominated by the United States. Not that that's going to happen, but really, Mark, why is America suddenly discovering soccer?
I don't know. Are they? Because I'm not. I
well,
see.
You live in a bubble here.
Do
with
I?
Your little preppy polo shirts.
What is the new thing I'm doing? Am I too old for this?
No, you're a liberal. You can do whatever you want.
but I don't think soccer is catching on. I see still, when I lived in Astoria in Queens,
yes.
you would hear literally all through the year pockets of people's shouting, crowds in different bars it's all international community.
It's all international, but now suddenly, like, oh, look at us. We have good team. We have Mia Hem, Mia
Do Bork, we have? Do we have a good team?
I think we have okay team.
Okay, all right.
Well, I don't say we. I like to be American when it's convenient.
Mm-hmm.
When World Cup, I don't like to be American. But, you know, what I say, Mark, let the Europeans have their sport. Let Africans have. Let Latin American. Why can't America stick to steroids in NFL?
Mm-hmm. I
you
understand.
Know what I mean? Can you imagine if they win? The last thing Europe needs is a bunch of stupid sorority girls in fleece and Birkenstocks cheering through streets of Stuttgart. Can you imagine?
No, I can't.
I have nightmares of these girls from my days on the college campus circuit.
You were on the college campus circuit.
Oh, for months. It's a good, it's good, these rich kids from these prep schools, Choate, Exeter, you know what I'm talking about.
Sure, sure.
A lot of Jewish kids, actually. A lot of Jewish kids. And they go, Russian hooker, oh, how exciting, they're becoming men, please.
Uh-huh.
Please.
So you helped them along. You ushered them through their
enough
rights.
Enough virgins, I was bored to tears. I mean, these guys have no coordination anyway. But
I was going to go to a prostitute as a virgin, but I was frightened.
You were.
Yeah, it didn't seem the way to go into it.
Well,
I'd rather.
I'm sorry you didn't call me, Mark.
I would have. Had I known you then, I certainly would have.
It would have been fantastic.
It still probably can be.
I like what you're talking about, Mark. But I have to say, you know what? I won't talk anymore about soccer because I don't want to make any enemies. You know, for all I know, there are these sweet American children with cancer who are soccer fans and I've destroyed their will to live or something.
Right. Well, I don't know if they're going to be listening to our show. Are we still doing movies? Is that part of
this
anymore?
Yes, we are doing movies.
Right.
Yes, of course.
Right.
I saw, what piece of crap did I see? Oh, Nacho Libre.
It's bad.
Well, you know, Mark, look.
Uh-huh.
I had seen Napoleon Dynamite, and I thought it was idiotic. Now, I know everyone is a fan of this movie, but it tried so hard to be culty.
It's quirky, I think, is the word. Quirky.
I could literally see them writing the script and designing the action figures at the same time.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
No, I mean, there's a whole geek sort of campy
kitsch. But tried really hard. Maybe it's because I was not raised in this country that I do not get kick out of ugly putts dancing on stage or large black woman named LaShonda. I mean, who cares?
She's the competition, I'm assuming.
Well, no, nice try. You know, maybe with the badunkadunk. But besides that, there's really nothing going on there. But
okay.
We didn't have prom or talent contests in my high school.
Uh-huh.
We were too busy harvesting, potatoes and avoiding gonorrhea.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
We don't have talent contests with Napoleon doing some sort of weird moonwalk. But, nevertheless, I did have high hopes for this film because the promo looked entertaining. And Jack Black is a fun, chubby guy.
He's funny. He's the new funny, chubby guy.
He's the new guy. And if only he were client.
Yeah, really?
I like
I'm sure,
it.
I
like when there's tires.
Uh-huh.
I like love handles.
Yeah.
I like jiggle,
really?
Jiggle. Yeah, it's just fun. It makes it more movement, like waterbed.
Yeah, yeah. My wife likes it too, and I'm a fan of the thin in me. In women, I don't mind a little.
Oh, okay.
Like,
I was about to say.
You're very
I'm voluptuous.
I like Zoftik, I think is the word.
Very, oh, you say the Nazi. That's nice. But this Mormon director, Jared Hess, you know, him and his wife are Mormons.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not racist, but please.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he manages to drag the movie out. Every shot is so self-indulgent. Like, look how weird my characters are. Look how weird my shots are. Here's funny chubby Jack Black running next to skinny Mexican guy. Hector Jimenez with a big smile. Do you know who he is? I have to say, though, he was fantastic.
Was he?
He's a client.
He's not the guy that was in Napoleon Dynamite, is he?
No.
Different guy.
No.
Hector Jimenez.
He's a client. I met him in Mexico City in 96. He was my first Latino.
Is there a difference?
Oh, that was when I started enjoying missionary position.
Oh, really?
Only Latinos can pull it off.
Really?
Everyone else, you are going to kill yourself from boredom. But the Latinos, and there's also a small tribe in Togo. They are good movers also, I have to say.
Togo?
Adela tribe.
I don't even know where that is.
I think it's near Namibia. I don't know. I did Africa for a short time because malaria, and I had a heart problem, and, you know, the Doctors Without Borders, giving me problems. They were lecturing me on prophylactics. I said, please.
Yeah.
I mean, look, come on. These people have no food. They're going to worry about condoms.
Right, come on now. Sure.
But the only redeeming factor here was a Jack Black who made me laugh every time he lifted his left eyebrow, which was about 63 times in the course of
the
film.
He's doing the eyebrow thing? Belushi used to do an eyebrow thing.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Client.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yes.
You probably did Belushi for free because he's funny, right?
Well, it wasn't that funny.
Yeah, right,
you know,
okay,
when they get sexual, it gets so crazy. Okay. But, you know, to the director and his wife, I say Jared, and you know his wife's name? Jerusha.
Jerusha?
What is that?
Is that Mormon or is it
apparently. It's like Jerusalem, but with a Mormon twist. Huh. I don't know what's going
Jerusha.
On there. I'd kill myself with a name like that.
Yeah.
I tell them, Jared, Jerusha, go back to Salt Lake City, make movies about the big miracle of Mormonism, i.e., this is the first time I'm incorporating i.e. The radio.
Sure, IE
works.
What
does it stand for?
It means... What does it stand for, Jim?
Something Latin, no?
For example, I think.
Oh, there you go. For
but
example.
But that's F-E.
For example.
F-E?
Oh, we're going to have to get to the bottom of this and get back to you.
It sounds intelligent. Yeah. I.E., how people with no sexuality manage to have 14 wives.
Right.
This is the secret of Mormonism.
Yeah, it's also the secret of, I think there's a pimp element to it, isn't there?
Hold on. I just got a text message. Hold on here. I'm loving this text message. Oh, it's from Dan Razor. Hold on.
He's sad, I'm sure.
Feeling blue, in need of butt rub, Danny. You know, I have to go. This poor guy, after so many years to be kicked in the testicles by CBS, it's
awful.
A disgrace.
It's just awful.
One flub and they never let you forget.
It's just awful. Will you take care of Dan Rather? Because we like him here.
Oh, don't worry. I'll make him feel happy.
Thanks for joining us, Svetlana.
Thank you. You know, I give. Just call me Smith. Svetlana Smith. I give up.
I'm going to learn the name. It's always a pleasure to see you.
You too, Mark.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
We will be back momentarily. We've got Robert Greenwald in a little while. And Rod Nordland, the news foreign correspondent for Newsweek, is going to talk about Iraq with us a little later in the show. Stay with us.
Keeps pulling out faster than the Japanese. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Okay. Hey, everybody knows Robert Greenwald. Everybody who listens to my show knows Robert Greenwald. Everyone who listens to Air America knows Robert Greenwald. Robert Greenwald and his company, Brave New Films, almost single-handedly started an effective progressive guerrilla documentary filmmaking movement. With films like Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism, Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price, Greenwald has made films that become available to the public quickly and motivate political action. Because of the Walmart film, grassroots activism has stopped Walmart from ruining many American small towns. And I think it's a direct result of his film. He is the producer of the new Tom DeLay movie. And he's with us. That movie's called The Big Buy, Tom DeLay's Stolen Congress. He's with us on the phone right now. How are you, Robert?
I'm excellent. Good to be with you.
It's nice to be with you, too. You know, we're doing an event together in San Diego.
Oh, yes.
The
right.
San Diego Democracy Fest.
They'll never be the same after we finish with
That's
it.
Right. Well, I was told that you were going to be premiering the Tom DeLay film there, but you're not. You've got a big plan for this film, a big outreach action.
Yes. Well, what we're doing with this film is what we've done with the others, is we're doing this alternative distribution, where if people go to TomDeLayMovie.com, the website, they can sign up either to buy a DVD or to buy a DVD and and have a house party, or to go a house party in their neighborhood so that they can experience the film with others, and then most importantly, build this community and take some action. On June 26th, we're going to have something called Clean Money Day, where a series of groups are going to, in support of Brave New Films, including the Courage Campaign and the bunch of DC groups, are all going to work together, groups that have been working on campaign finance reform for a long time, and say, you know what, Tom DeLay is gone. The bunch of his followers are still around, but we've got to get to the heart of the problem, and the heart of the problem is these corporations that give all this money.
Well, they're going down, man. There's a lot of them that are going down. I imagine the movie is covering that as well, because that's still unfolding. You know, I talked to Mark Birnbaum and Jim Schermbeck a while back, I think before they even had closure on DeLay being indicted. And they were kind of waiting to finish the movie. I mean, this movie took a long time to make because we had to see how this was going to play out.
Absolutely. Well, fortunately, we've seen how it's played out. And now I think the job of all of us is to take the film and, as with the others, use it as a tool to get out there, show to people, change people's minds, let them have some laughs. The movie has some laughs, and Mark and Jim did an absolutely first-rate job.
Uh-huh.
And then worked so that we get this, you know, get this blood money out of politics,
well,
which is totally distorting the system.
I think you're absolutely right, and I hope that that this manifests some movement towards that, like your other films have towards Walmart. But I tell you, these guys are going to have to make a sequel, because all these secondary characters, you know, David Safavian went down. That's the Bush administration guy who he's in the Abramoff trial. Jack Abramoff's going to go down. There's still no knowing how many people will be dragged down with this guy.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic in one sense, because it's when the bad guys get their due, like in any good Western or morality tale, it is a time for celebrating, and we should celebrate. I mean, if we had said a year ago that DeLay was going down, or, you know, people would have thought we were nuts. So it's really been a terrific victory that a lot of people all over the country have worked very hard to make happen, so that as they say in the film, so that justice is done, because it really is about good cops and bad cops. And there's more work to be done. Again, I think we all understand how corporate money coming into the political system gets people elected who shouldn't be, and then they follow the money and they vote for those who've got them in there. So we've got some work to do. The nurses have an initiative on the ballot, a clean money initiative that we can support. So there are lots of good possibilities to try to do something, not just talk about it.
And it would also, I think, ultimately eradicate the temptation of our politicians to prostitute themselves.
Yes, absolutely. You're completely right. I mean, there are states where they have essentially clean money has passed.
Yeah.
I think Maine being one of them. And it's really changing the process where people go out and they campaign on issues they care about, and they don't spend all their time. I mean, frankly, the people we're electing, what we know about them, they're great fundraisers.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to, I mean, and even good folks, they spend hours every day dialing for dollars, and it's just a complete perversion of democracy.
Yeah, it's because they can just buy the vote.
Yeah.
Well, look, let's talk a little bit about Brave New Film, because I'm just curious about some things. It seems to me that you are sitting in a position where you're now producing films and you're getting behind them in this way. Do you take unsolicited films? How are you finding? Because there's a lot of people out there that you've inspired to make these type of films. I have to imagine that you've got a lot of incoming possibilities.
Well, let me answer that in a couple of ways. First of all, we have 13, almost 1,400 people now around the country who volunteered to be Brave New Films field producers, and they sign up. They go to any one of our websites, the Tom DeLay or the Walmart movie website. They sign up, and then we use them. We have people who are volunteering. They're doing research. Some people are doing editing. Some people come in and film stuff for us, and it's around the country. So that's one thing where people definitely can participate. The other thing is we are hard at work, and I just literally stopped for 10 minutes because I love talking to you, is that the film for the fall is called Iraq for Sale, The War Profiteers.
Oh, good.
And you can imagine what that's about. And we're going to need tremendous help to spread spread the word, to get it out, to have screenings at schools and hospitals and any place you can think of, because this is an extraordinary, powerful issue that has been literally swept under the table, in the sense that people are not outraged, that we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars going into the hands of greedy corporations.
Some of it's just still missing. Billions of dollars still missing.
And the stories we're getting, and we're getting personal stories from truck drivers who, I'm not going to name the corporations.
Contractors?
Truck drivers who are working for contractors,
yeah.
And what's going on,
huh.
And how the taxpayer is being fleeced by no oversight. And it's really an outrageous situation, but it's also something, the movie will be out in September.
Excellent.
That people will be able to see and take action in terms of who they're going to vote for and who they're not going to vote for.
Our guest is Robert Greenwald, documentary filmmaker, producer, overseer of Brave New Films, incredible and successful experiment in spreading the word and educating people. Do you find that have you had any stories of resistance in terms of where your films are played? Like you mentioned schools, you mentioned maybe community organizations. Have there been incidents where people have tried to show your films and been shut down?
Yes, we had a few. Actually, there was with the Walmart movie. There
mm-hmm.
was a couple of screenings in libraries, surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
Where they said, no, we couldn't show it, and then people raised a ruckus and got it shown. And, of course, if you go into your local Walmart, they're not carrying the film, even though we offered to do a screening for them and, all those things.
Yeah, right.
You know, the wonderful thing about this independent or this alternative distribution,
yeah.
Any place there's a TV screen, they can't stop us.
You just throw it on.
You just throw it on and you invite people over. Plus, with this way, you reach people who disagree with you, the relatives who disagree with you, or someone at church, or someone at school, or someone at work.
That's right. You ruin a Thanksgiving dinner.
Exactly. Yeah. You remember?
Awesome. Well, okay. Is there any interest in any of your many hundreds of correspondents out there to do a documentary on the voting machines?
Actually, there's several being done, and I think they'll be out by the fall.
Okay.
Now, it's important. It's a tricky issue, the voting machines, because what's really important is that you give people action to take, because otherwise people say, oh, what's the point of voting, or, oh, they're going to cheat us again.
That's right.
And there's lots of very concrete action at the local levels about organizing, about protecting the voting rights, about protecting voting machines. So we need to be very careful with that issue on our side, because we can't let it turn into a kind of the sky is falling or a victimization. We have to say, yes, there are problems, they're fixable, and we can organize around them and we can do something.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. Great talking to you, Robert.
Our pleasure.
I'll see you down in San Diego.
You got it.
Okay,
Bye-bye.
Buddy. Bye. That was Robert Greenwald. Big plans. That's an impressive organization.
I mean, given the incredibly low voter turnout in the primaries, you got to give them something to do. Something,
absolutely.
A solution.
I think it's starting to turn a little bit. We're going to be back. We'll have Professor William Chandler, America's 10 Greatest Mistakes. Stay with us.
He thinks he can dance. Mark Maron.
All right. Okay. Now, folks, there's absolutely no question that our country has committed many grievous errors, if not criminal acts, in its short history as a democracy. Our next guest presents an argument that every successful republic must commit these kinds of mistakes if it is to evolve into a true democracy. And he lists 10 of the most important ones in his soon-to-be-published cover story for Harper's Magazine called A Democracy in Transition, How America Learned from Its 10 Greatest Mistakes. He's a very respected historian at Princeton University, and over the years has published many books on the American experiment, as he calls it. Welcome to the show, Professor William Chandler.
Thank you, Mark.
In your article, you list 10 of the greatest mistakes made by our country, before we talk about them, what's your take on this? Can today's leaders really learn from mistakes of the past?
Oh yeah, man, because if you learn, and then you have that stuff right in your head, right? So you won't do it again. Like, like the Indians.
Okay.
Right?
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Well, like Wounded Knee, for instance. I noticed that you didn't include that in your list. Did the American nation as a whole learn from that incident? Has it contributed to a greater enlightenment, if you will, of our culture in relation to the human condition of non-white colonized populations?
Oh yeah, sure.
Well.
Well, what?
Wounded Knee.
Oh yeah, I believe it contributed to a greater enlightenment, if you will, of our culture in relation to the human condition of non-white colonized populations. No brainer there.
Yeah.
And when Wounded Knee happened, circa 1890. The American nation as a whole did learn from that incident, right?
Okay. Let's go through some of the mistakes in your list. There's the Civil War.
Yeah, that was bad for the country. It shouldn't have happened for one thing, but it did. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Brother fighting against brother, blue and gray.
Right.
Goober peas.
Yeah. Well, I noticed that you listed the Korean War twice on the list.
What?
You listed the Korean War two times. It's mistake number four, and then later again, it's mistake number seven.
Oh, yeah, that was a mistake. My proofreader didn't discover that until the last minute. Didn't have time to run another one. Maybe I should have put Wounded Knee in there or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. The Great Depression.
Yeah, that was another one I listed.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that was another example of the U.S. giving too much power to greedy industrialists so they can manipulate a flawed economic system to fill their own pockets.
Am I doing okay? I mean, how's this going so far?
Look, Professor William Chandler, author of A Democracy in Transition, How America Learned from Its 10 Greatest Mistakes, I noticed you didn't include Wounded Knee, but you did list the Battle of Little Bighorn. Can you explain that, please?
Well, sure, they're both related to all bad things we did to the Indians that were wrong. You read the article, right?
Yes, I sure did.
Okay, well, then take Chief Sitting Bull, for instance.
Uh-huh.
Okay, see, that was wrong, what we did there to him, I mean. And by we, I of course mean the collective experience of the American psyche is deconstructed by the postmodern Dadaists.
Whoa. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm kind of slow here, but what the hell does that mean?
I don't know, man. Is this going okay so far or what? I don't know.
Whoa. Professor, please. You want to try this again when you're a little better prepared, sir?
Sure, Mark. Any time in particular. I'm off all next week, I'm free.
I guess.
No, wait. That's last year's calendar. You know what my schedule is next week?
No, I don't. Goodbye, Professor William Chandler from Princeton.
Oh, man, I suck.
All right. Sometimes these interviews don't necessarily work out the way they're supposed to. I don't know what where he was at or what the problem was, but the article is a good read, and despite whatever problems the professor seemed to be having today, I will still recommend it. Jim, it felt a little awkward to me.
Yeah, Jim, I did you read the article or?
No, I did, and it was very lucid. It had a lot to say. I mean, people are going to read it next month in Harper's, and I don't. Who the hell knows what the hell was going on with him? It's just embarrassing.
People just aren't prepared for an interview is probably the problem.
Yeah, that happens. That happens. That's true. Maybe we'll try him again another time. I do want to put this out there to some of our listeners who will enjoy this. Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania's approval rating has skidded to a 4-year low, folks. This guy's in trouble, and it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. I've seen a lot of beautiful things in a Schadenfreude kind of way, but Bob Casey is leading Santorum by 52% to 34%, and that is the biggest margin since October when they were about tied. And this guy is one of the biggest butt kissers of the president there is. Now, you know, the president's approval ratings are pretty damn low, and his lead is about around the same as the approval rating. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but he is one of the most righteous, moralizing, hyper-religious, you know, as I said, lapdogs of this presidential administration. He's got that pomposity that you really want to see crumble. And I am very excited about it. And also, when his wife had a stillborn baby, they slept with it. So he's not a well person.
I shouldn't be laughing at that, but
it's creepy. You got a family. If something like that happens, you know how you teach your family about death. You know how you teach kids about death. You buy them a hamster. You buy them a goldfish. You don't take their dead sibling home and have it at the dinner table. It's disgusting.
Sounds like an old Night Gallery episode.
He is an old Night Gallery episode. And he was wearing a seersucker suit the other day and a pink tie. Not that that implies anything, but the fact that he is such a Catholic conservative whack job out there trying to look casual and on the mark. He's a despicable. Heinous.
Well, all this is good news and everything, but do you think the Democrats can really win anything until they come to a consensus about the Iraq War?
I think we got to be careful how much we say that because we all say it, and I don't know. I think they can still win things. I think Casey's definitely going to win this, but I think you're right. I think it would behoove them to make a decision and stand by it because the country is with them. Be back in a second. Please stay here. Could you? Yeah.
Now back to the poor man's Ryan Seacrest, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Hey, folks, we are on the brink of a possible nuclear conflict with North Korea and Iran. Iraq continues to spiral out of control. The Taliban is back in Afghanistan, and the president continues to imply it's just part of the process. With us on the phone is Newsweek's chief foreign correspondent, Rod Nordlund. Nice to talk to you again, Rod Nordlund. It's been a while. How can the president claim that Iraq is getting better when the insurgents were able to take 85 people hostage? I mean, what did they have, buses? What happened there today?
Well, yeah, they had buses. I mean, they've just been doing one brazen thing after another. And this one happened after the government, you know, announced its bold new security plan, put 70,000 supposedly troops and police on the streets to really get things under control.
Now, it seems that the Al-Qaeda alliance is still alive and well post-Zarqawi. I mean, two soldiers were mutilated in this brazen action. And from what I understand, there was a dispatch from the American embassy in Baghdad prior to Bush's trip that reported it's more dangerous in the green zone than it has been almost ever. Is that the way it is?
Yeah, that's the way it is. You know what? I mean, what I always say about Iraq is it only gets worse. And so far, I haven't been disappointed. I mean, getting Zarqawi was a little bit of good news and certainly a positive step. But even as the Americans warned at the time, that wasn't going to solve the problem of Al-Qaeda. I mean, it is true that those guys who were taken prisoner, they probably had the intention of parading them on television and so on, and probably had decided to kill them quickly because they were under so much pressure. The U.S. flooded the area with so many troops searching for them that it looks like they kind of hurriedly killed them. But no, they're certainly not a spent force.
What is the condition of the alliance between the jihadist faction of the insurgency and the nationalist faction? Because there was some speculation that the nationalist faction sort of tipped off Zarqawi's location because he was overreaching. Do you see that alliance as being damaged?
Yes, somewhat. I mean, there have been some indications. There are a lot of hardline Sunnis who previously would not criticize Al-Qaeda prior to Zarqawi's death, who since then have been denouncing Al-Qaeda and Zarqawi. So there have been some early signs that they might be willing to try to enter into dialogue with the government. And the government's made some gestures on its part. It released a lot of prisoners, partly as a gesture to those elements of Iraqi society. But it's a little early to see how that's going to go. And the government here has only just been formed. It's about a week old now. And they haven't really been able to do anything substantive yet.
All right, well, let's talk about today here in the States. It's been revealed that that two members of the California National Guard were not killed in an ambush, but they were killed by the Iraqi soldiers they were patrolling with. This was in 2004. But what is the reality in terms of Americans actually training and working with the Iraqi National Forces? Has that begun to improve? Has there been any real movement in terms of either the Iraqis working independently? Is that happening?
Just a couple of days ago, I went up to Taji, which is the big training center for training the Iraqi army. And they had a ceremony where they're announcing the transfer of control of a big chunk of territory north of Baghdad to this new Iraqi army division. On paper it sounded great. They were getting this big chunk of territory. They were going to be solely in charge of it. You know, they had a parade where they drove around and it drove their new tanks around,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. But the reality, when you talk to them, I mean, even the Iraqis general and the American officers that work with them, you know, admit they can't even handle their own logistics. They can't feed their own troops. They're completely dependent on the Americans for their communications and their air support and other things of that sort. So they're a long way from that.
Okay, well, Rod Nordlund, Newsweek Baghdad bureau chief. Let's talk then, essentially, that the two sides of this. The one question is there's a contingent here in the States that says that the Americans are exacerbating the civil war and they are becoming cannon fodder and target practice for terrorists and their presence there is not going to allow this thing to settle. But from what you just said, it seems to me that if the Americans were there just to leave, I mean, how would that play itself out?
Well, I think most people agree that if the Americans left tomorrow, on Friday, there'd be widespread civil war. It would just devolve into a war of various militias, and the Sunni insurgency being one kind of militia, and then several Shia militias, and the Kurds, and the country would just rip apart. And that quite likely that what would happen. In the face of such a disastrous outcome, it would drag in Iran in support of the Shia and maybe Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and other Arab countries in support of the Sunnis, and Turkey in the north, worried about the Kurds becoming independent, and it would be a complete mess, and we'd have that to live down. I think it would be a political and strategic disaster for the United States.
Do you think that's why the Iranian president has put off addressing the White House request to honor terms around nuclear development? Do you think he's waiting to see what happens in Iraq? He said he's not going to address this until August. Do you think there's a sense that he is waiting to see how Iraq continues to unfold to see if he can make a power play?
No, I think the Iranians are getting everything they want in Iraq. They have a friendly government dominated by the Shia, who are quite close to them. And they have the U.S., their supposed enemy, tied down here, losing troops, losing prestige, spending a huge amount of money. And, if nothing else, Iraq guarantees that we're not about to attack Iran because we can't handle this war, let alone start another.
Okay, last question, Rod Nordlund. Today, seven Marines and one sailor are being charged with murder. Three Army soldiers have been charged with murder. The Haditha investigations continue. Is this the tip of the iceberg?
Well, I think it's the military finally getting serious about doing something about these cases when they occur. I don't think it's an iceberg of cases where American soldiers are deliberately murdering people.
Yeah.
But they're having quite a few cases, and in the past that they weren't investigated. I mean, the Haditha case is a perfect example of a case where there was abundant evidence at all levels from early on that something terrible had happened to a bunch of innocent women and children and old people. That this unit had gone berserk, and it was covered up right up the chain of command, and probably quite high up the chain of command, until finally they just couldn't deny it any longer. And I think there's a recognition politically that they have to make sure these cases are addressed. But I don't think it's the case that American soldiers are running around Iraq murdering people left and right.
Well, that's good.
That certainly is the impression a lot of Iraqis have.
Right. Well, thank you so much for the information, Rod Nordlund. I really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye. Wow. I haven't talked to him since sedition. It's always very sobering and disturbing. But we will come back and do jokes nonetheless. So stay with us.
Moving to Florida for the $100 beef burger, Mark Maron.
Oh, I read about that. I have. Can I be honest with you? Can we digress a bit?
Of course.
From all the serious talk we've had today, I've been trying to. I've been dieting a little bit, and it's making me feel happy because I come from a mother who is a compulsive dieter. So when I actually start to watch my weight, I feel that I'm honoring my mom. Isn't that sweet?
Oh, that's really nice. That's touching.
Yeah, I literally, after my first year at college, I got down to 165, which is emaciated for a guy my size. I look like Bill Kohler, who is emaciated for a guy his size. Yet he claims to eat, but
what?
I don't
know. No, what is your height?
I'm having a heart palpitation. Do you ever get those?
Not anymore.
I've been having those a lot lately.
The drugs mask that.
I'm not drinking any coffee or nothing, and I'm getting these little like ding 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 dinks. You never got those?
Maybe that's acid reflux.
No, it is not acid reflux. But anyways, I'm 5'11", so that was a little thin for me. And when I got home, I was like, "Mommy, look!" And she was proud. My wife cannot stand me thin though.
I'm 5'11".
No, you're not. You're a little higher, aren't you?
No, I'm 5'11", and I have calculated my exact body mass index, which is the way you calculate whether or not you're a healthy weight to height ratio and body mass.
Uh-huh.
And I am right in the center of the healthy.
You're like about 175?
No, I weigh like 150, 155.
You're 5'11"?
Yeah.
And you weigh 155?
150, 155, it fluctuates according to.
But you're
like
a lanky guy.
Yes, but that's the way people were, you know, before we started eating them.
That's not true.
100 years ago.
That's not true. There were always fat people.
Of course, there's always been fat people, yes, but those have been people who have been, like, you know.
Predisposed to fatness?
I think they were exposed to the wrong diet.
I don't know. A lot of times, like, the peasant diet, although it was healthy, was pretty loaded with carbs, my friend.
Carbs, but you know, but they knew not to engorge themselves.
I don't know. Look at pictures. I think you might be sorely mistaken.
A lot of fat people. I looked at old pictures of my genealogy, and there are a lot of very slender people.
You are genetically slender, dude.
On
the
farm.
You eat donuts. You eat chocolate. You're one of those lucky people. And I think Bill might be one of them, too, unless he's hiding something, that can just eat and eat and eat and just never gain an ounce. You are a beacon of contempt for those of us who have to struggle to maintain weight. Ask Andy how much he hates you. Laughing Andy secretly wants to be slender, but he likes to eat those pocket pizzas too much. I see him out there. And
he's eating a goose when he goes home. I go home and I have vegetables and brown rice and other delicious spiced things.
What about the eight donuts? You eat donuts all day long.
I don't eat them all day or every day. Occasionally I do, but you know I try to get off of that.
Oh, you're on your high horse. I think that if you look at pictures of the world from the beginning of photography, you'll find there's a fat, smiling man in every one of them somewhere.
Of course, but that's because they've been exposed. Maybe they're rich enough to expose themselves to their own desires too much and to feed those desires.
I think that's a fallacy. I think that some people are just fat, and they're designed that way. And if you were to see them thin, you'd be like, oh, my God, what's wrong with you?
But the history of fatness has you know, there are many more percentage of fat people today than there were 100 years ago or 150 years ago. That's because 150 years ago, people lived primarily on farms and ate mostly a vegetarian diet.
But vegetarian diets, dude, I've seen some of the fattest, doughiest people are just fat old vegetarian hippie people. They're fat. You can't eat peanut butter and beans all damn day and not expect to put on a few.
You're not supposed to eat peanut butter and beans. That's ridiculous.
Tell that to my old roommate, Brad. That was disgusting. And the stuff that would come out of that guy, the gas, oh, jeez.
Well, you gotta cook it right.
Huh?
Cook the beans right and don't combine it with peanut butter. What are you living in, the Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, for God's sake?
No, you know I'm making a point here. You know, we have to, I think that there are some fat vegetarian hippies that have to take responsibility for their own obesity. The argument that it's all about vegetarian diet is not quite right, because I've seen plenty of, let me tell you something, disturbingly doughy vegetarians, and that is not a fat-free diet, my friend. I've tried. It's not a fat-free diet.
No, it isn't. But, you know, it's animal fat. It's plant fat as opposed to animal fat, which is much healthier. And if you balance it the right way.
Healthy's fine, but it's still fat.
If you balance it the right way and don't have incredibly large portions, you know.
Well,
I mean, look at Italy. They should be all fat.
A lot of them are.
But you know, they're not half as much as they are here because they have portions.
You're a fattest.
I am.
There's
a tyranny of the fat in this country.
I agree.
A tyranny of the fat and the smokers. Fat smokers are above the fat and the smokers.
Let me tell you something. I honestly have noticed a tremendous decline in smokers. I don't know. I understand what you're saying, but I think that most people who smoke, if they're not young, are hip to the fact that they shouldn't be. And I think a lot of the laws that were put in place, though they are draconian, some of them, have worked in waking people up to how bad cigarettes are. It's interesting that everywhere in this country, people smoked indoors. And now if you go in some place where people smoke, it's like, oh, my God, everything smelled like that at one point in time, and no one noticed. That's amazing. But smoking is bad. Food is not bad. And I'll be honest with you, no matter how well you balance your diet, good fat, bad fat, if you see an obese person that is lumbering down the street or in one of those sad fat wheelchairs, and you were to go, Jesus, what the hell is wrong with you? And they were to go, no, it's the good fat. It doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference.
They say, 10-1, they're not a vegetarian.
All right, well, okay. Yeah. Now we're talking hypotheticals.
You don't see vegetarians that
fat. I'll agree, it's an obesity problem, but I'm saying that there's always been fat people, and there was a time where it was okay to be fat. You heard Svetlana tonight. Some people like to grab hold of some fatty fat. You know, I'm uncomfortable with it in my own skin, and I think...
Zoftig.
Yeah, but she likes fat men. You know, or chubby men. And I know people that, like, my wife, literally, if I lose too much, like, if I get much thinner than I am now, she will not let me have sex with her because she said it feels like I'm a crab person. Like, I'm climbing onto her, and I'm this spindly, weird, spider-like person. And I've gotten thin enough to where my eyes kind of get bugged out, and I get a little gaunt. And I'm like, I feel great. And people are like, are you sick? And you would say that's good, though, because I was eating well.
People think that slender people are, quote, skinny, when in fact they're slender. And they're naturally slender, and they're naturally healthy because they're slender and have a healthy diet. And that's the tyranny of the fat.
But there's
a difference. Somebody comes up to you because you're slender, and they say, oh, you're skinny. You have something to eat. That's, you know, come on.
Yeah, but that's not cultural. That could be a familial thing. I mean, my grandmother's like that. I mean, come on, you can't knock the history of people
that's
wanting to feed their kids.
100 years of meat eating and fat eating and lard ingestion
that's ridiculous.
Fat lardy behind and doing nothing.
I'll tell you another thing, though. There's plenty of people that are slender and they're weird looking. There's manorexia. That's what it's called. It's called manorexia, where you get these 42, 43-year-old, primarily gay men who are relentlessly gymming it and constantly working out to the point where they look impractical. They look bizarre. They look freakish because they don't let themselves get doughy. I want the freedom, damn it, as I get older, to get doughy without feeling self-conscious, Jim. You're never going to have to worry about that.
I'm doughy. I have dough on me.
Oh, I got to do the jokes.
Don't call me undoughy.
You're anti-dough. You're a doughist and an obesist, a fattist. You hate fat people. Here's the jokes. Short order news. Jeez. A Tampa coast-to-coast convenience store has installed a device that scans your fingerprint to process payment through a debit account. Despite what they are being told, female customers should be warned that the device is a machine and not the store clerk's mouth. The company advises not to whip off the clerk and say, can I pay with this? Yo, can I play with this? Read this. Japan announced yesterday that it's going to pull... Oh, my God, I didn't pick the other jokes. Japan announced yesterday that it's going to pull its 600 troops from Iraq. Let's just try. The Japanese troops have suffered no casualties, although there have been several cases of homesickness, and one guy complained that it was the worst sex tour he'd ever been on. Oh, that was a good pick. All right, here it. A state judge on Tuesday spared the life of Louis the Cat, whose vicious attacks on neighbors landed his owner in court. The cat's owner must complete 2 years of probation and build a scratching post that looks like Mrs. Henderson.
What's Mrs. Henderson?
I don't know. The cat will now serve the first of 9 life sentences.
Okay, yeah.
That's good. Let's just grab another one that I haven't read. Authorities are still trying to figure out how the feline was behind the wheel of a drive-by clawing last... Not doing that. The owner also had a cat named Martin who has not played with Lewis in years. Oh, boy. Do these count as me doing them? I got to pay these fellas. Hey, Jim, it's been great. What a great day.
Good show.
I feel bad. I'm going to go back and maybe do those jokes tomorrow. Hey, tomorrow, Maria Bamford, who I worked with the other night, who I am a huge fan of, who is hysterically unique and funny, will be on the show with some reflections on her mother, who also has an eating issue. Glenn Greenwald, author of How Would a Patriot Act, is going to be here. Also, Polly Parsons, about her play Taking the Jesus Pill, and also a book that she was involved with about her father, Graham Parsons. That's Graham Parsons'
daughter. Wow.
Yeah, very cool. So that's that. I hope that did it for you. Good night, sheeple. Oh, wait, this one's a good one. Can I...